destroyed homes. Asked about the airstrikes on May 10th, which left 9 Palestinian children dead, Ned Price, the spokesperson for the U.S. State Department, refused to condemn the Israeli aggression. Joining me is the Palestinian ambassador to Austria and permanent observer at the United Nations, Mr. Salah Abdel Shafi. It's great to have you on the program, Your Excellency. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
So, Your Excellency, Israel is forcing several families to leave their homes. It's evicting them, specifically in Sheikh Jarrah in occupied East Jerusalem. You know, these families have lived there for generations, and yet the Israelis want them to leave and to give these homes to Jewish settlers. I mean, this issue seems to be receiving barely any media coverage. Are you concerned by the lack of condemnation from other countries and the international community at large?
No, absolutely. I mean, there is clearly double standards here. Beside of what is happening in Jerusalem, ethnic cleansing, eviction of people from their homes that they've been living in for generations. Let me give you a recent example. You know, the organization Human Rights Watch just issued recently a very detailed report describing Israel as an apartheid system. Now, usually, Western media and Western politicians would love to quote reports of Human Rights Watch when they talk about Egypt or Iran or Turkey. But when it comes to Israel, unfortunately, we haven't heard anything. Take, for example, the Austrian media here, nothing. Or we haven't seen any or heard any comment from major European politicians. We heard even critique to this report. So again, this shows this double standard policy. But again, we have to use all international law tools that are at our disposal. One of them is the International Criminal Court. And we have to challenge the Western world and say, you always defended the International Criminal Court. And now we have clear cases that Palestine, the state of Palestine, presented to the court. The least that we expect from those who claim to be democratic countries is to show some respect to the International Criminal Court, to show us some respect to reports by credible human rights organizations.
During the last weeks, we've seen extremely unsettling images and footage coming out of Jerusalem, particularly Israelis chanting death to Arabs and openly beating Palestinians in the street. You know, once again, how do you feel by the lack of response from the international community? And I mean, how do you react to the mainstream media calling these events quote-unquote clashes instead of pogroms or violence against Palestinians?
You see, unfortunately, you know, the international community in general, there are of course exceptions, deals with Israel as if it is a country above the law. That is why we see, really, we don't see condemnations of racist Jewish Israeli attacks on Palestinians, the likes we've seen recently in Jerusalem, but we've been seeing this for more than 50 years under occupation. Again, I think the cause of Palestine poses a major challenge to Western democracies, because the cause of Palestine, in addition of being a political issue, it's an issue about international law, it's about international humanitarian law, it's about respecting human rights of Palestinians, and that's why these are the values that the West claims that their policies is guided by these values. That's why we're asking, why do they stop criticizing when it comes to Israel? Is Israel a state above the law? Are the standards that are applicable universally to all countries are not applicable to Israel. Again, I think we don't need, we know that this is a long-term process, that we need to work with the public opinion in these countries, with the civil society organization. We do know and we feel that the Palestinian cause enjoys a lot of popular support in Europe and worldwide. However, this popular support should be ultimately reflected in the policies of governments.
So, I mean, given all these tensions that are taking place in Jerusalem recently, you know, I've seen various media outlets moving to describe them as an intifada. Do you think that's an accurate term to describe what's going on, or is that perhaps a bit too loaded?
You see, it's really difficult to at this stage to speak about intifada, because the concept of intifada is a much wider, is a popular movement that is involving each and every corner of the occupied Palestinian territories. However, it could be, because the centrality of the question of Jerusalem, the sensitivity of the issue of Jerusalem, politically, religiously, it might trigger a much wider reaction and comes to a third intifada.
Your Excellency, Ambassador Abdel Shafi, it's great speaking with you and having you on the program. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Various media outlets, politicians, and people on social media continue to pretend that the Palestinian issue is a complicated issue. This is not a complicated issue. Palestine has been under illegal occupation since 1948 by Zionist settlers who are ethnically cleansing Palestine to make way for more Jewish settlers. People think that the current situation in Sheikh Jarrah is also complicated or unique. It is not unique. It is not new. How do they think that Israel came into existence? Since 1948, millions of Palestinians have been kicked out of their homes and made into refugees, both within Palestine and without, and all of them rendered stateless. Millions of Palestinians are still living daily under Israeli military occupation and Zionist oppression, where they are treated like third-class citizens and shot, killed, and bombed on their own land, while the whole world idly stands by and does nothing. This is a disgrace upon everyone who watches what is happening there and says nothing. The Palestinian issue is not complex when someone has rocks and the other has nuclear warheads, along with the full backing of the West. This is not an equal fight or a level playing field. This is a bloodbath. This is an occupation. So to look at this situation and pretend that one can be neutral or impartial is completely, utterly absurd. You are either on the side of the oppressed, of the Palestinians, or you are on the side of the oppressors, the Israelis. It is that simple and always has been. When the Israelis burst into the Aqsa Mosque, of all places, while people are praying and desecrated during the holy month of Ramadan, no less, this is such an extraordinary grave act of disrespect. It's truly hard to put into words how despicable and grotesque this behavior is. I mean, it would be disgraceful to do that in any mosque regardless, but to do that during Ramadan at one of the holiest sites in Islam exposes the level of contempt and disregard the Israelis harbor for the Palestinians and the way that they treat them. It seems there's no line that the Israelis won't cross. Their animosity towards Palestinians knows no bounds. It is outrageous what Israel is able to get away with. How do they dare to evict Palestinians on Palestinian land and render them homeless and the world does nothing? How do they dare to storm Al-Aqsa Mosque and the world says nothing? How do they dare to kill children and the world says nothing? How do they openly chant death to Arabs and the world says nothing? This is beyond despicable. This is evil. The Israeli regime is a genocidal entity. It has zero legitimacy and is nothing more than a brutal military occupation created and subsidized by the West. Its racist apartheid behavior will be recorded for history, for all to see when future generations, and they will look back on this period in time and they will wonder how this was ever allowed to happen to Palestinian people. But let us make one thing clear. Despite these Israeli attacks, despite the occupation year in and year out, despite the animosity of the West and the indifference of the rest, Palestine will be free from the river to the sea. This is only a matter of time. The resistance and muqawama will prevail. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Senate Budget Chairman Bernie Sanders sharply criticized the U.S. abnormally large defense budget and the fraud and misconduct of defense contractors in a hearing on Pentagon spending. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Sharon Jung Ryder. This article is published under the heading Sanders slams Pentagon for waste, fraud, and abuse, vows more stringent oversight. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Senate Budget Chairman Bernie Sanders sharply criticized the country's abnormally large defense budget and the fraud and misconduct of defense contractors in a hearing on Pentagon spending. The Pentagon has a budget of whopping $740 billion this year. That makes up more than half of the discretionary spending authorized by Congress. This figure would be a lot on its own, but as Sanders pointed out in the hearing, the Department of Defense is often wasteful in its spending and often racks up cost overruns despite a staggeringly large budget. The time is long overdue for us to take a hard look at the enormous amount of waste and the cost overruns and fraud, and of the financial mismanagement that has plagued the Department of Defense and the military-industrial complex for decades, said Sanders. At a time when we have so many unmet needs in America, we've got to ask ourselves why we are spending more on the military than the next 12 nations combined. Sanders pointed out that the U.S. military budget is larger than it was during the Cold War, and that the Defense Department continually fails to complete an independent audit. Indeed, the Pentagon failed its audit last year, as it has done for the past 3 years in a row, and many others in the past. In 2013, Reuters reported that defense employees were using fake accounting numbers to balance the department's budget and have been for decades. Officials have said that the agency won't be ready to pass an audit until 2027 at the earliest. Failing to complete audits, Sanders said, is a large contributor to problems of waste, fraud, and abuse at the agency. Much of the nation's defense budget goes toward defense contractors like Lockheed Martin and Boeing. In fact, over half of the Pentagon's budget goes toward these private contractors, and that spending has grown year by year. In 2020, the Pentagon awarded $445 billion of the $714 billion it spent that year to contractors. And these companies, Sanders points out, are often paying fines for fraud while profiting off of their contracts. Sanders said since 1995, Boeing, Lockheed Martin, and Raytheon have paid over $5.4 billion in fines or related settlements for fraud or misconduct. Further, I find it interesting that despite the fact that the lion's share of revenue for some of the defense contractors comes from the taxpayers of the United States, these same companies provide their CEOs and executives excessive and extremely large compensation packages. In 2020, Lockheed Martin paid its CEO $23 million, Sanders points out, while 95% of the company's revenue was from government contracts. Raytheon's CEO received $19.4 million, while 94% of the company's revenue came from government contracts. These companies, for all intents and purposes, almost function as government agencies. Vast majority of their revenue coming from the public, and yet their CEOs make almost 100 times more than the Secretary of State, Sanders continued. Many people, including Sanders, have criticized the department's enormous budget over the years and have called for a drastic reduction in that spending. Progressives argue that more defense spending does not make us safer. Rather, it is wasteful and at best only fuels further violence. It is time to hold the DOD to the same level of accountability as the rest of the government, said Sanders. We do not need a defense budget that is bloated, that is wasteful, and that has, in too many cases, massive fraud, he added.
Around the World with Reporters.
More Palestinians have been killed and hundreds others have been wounded in a fresh Israeli crackdown on the occupied West Bank. The crackdown came in several areas after Palestinians held rallies to denounce Israel's massacres in the besieged Gaza Strip.
Gaza is under bombing. All Palestinians must take part in the protests and go to the military checkpoints. If we stay at our homes, nothing will change. We must fight those Israeli occupying soldiers wherever they are.
We are all in one tunnel, all Palestinians who live in the lands that were occupied in 1948, in Al-Quds, in the West Bank, and in Gaza. We are today fighting, by different means, the Israeli occupation. Innocent people and children are being killed in cold blood. The least to do is to protest.
In occupied Ramallah, hundreds of Palestinians intensified their participation in the ongoing anti-Israel protests. Following Friday prayers, people from all walks of life and from different political affiliation marched toward the Beit Il military checkpoint located outside the city. Palestinian activists taking part in the protest said the crimes and violence by the Israeli forces require a serious reaction.
Our battle is won. We are all today united in defense of our goods. The Israeli occupation is the enemy of the Palestinian people, wherever they are. After all these years, the Palestinians in the land occupied in 1948 are sending a message to the occupying regime that nothing succeeded to let them forget their historical rights, change their culture and identity.
Israeli forces' violence has also seen a spike in the Palestinian cities occupied in 1948, like Lod, Akka, and Haifa, including attacks by Israeli settlers and destruction of Palestinian property and the burning of mosques, amid the Israeli regime's fears the conflict could even spread.
Protests against Israel's full-scale war on the besieged Gaza Strip have spiraled rapidly all over the occupied territories. Palestinians say a new uprising against Israel is in the making here in the occupied West Bank and Jerusalem. Al-Quds and definitely will read to the lands occupied in 1948. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Wrongful detainment, deportation, and denial of legal rights predominantly affecting Britain's Caribbean communities, known as the Windrush scandal, first made headlines several years ago, mostly impacting the generations who had legally migrated to the UK between the late 1940s and early 1970s. Despite government promises to tackle the problem, many more in Britain's black communities continue to be traumatised by government policies, which critics characterise as racist, and which were recently slammed in a High Court ruling, which suggested that Home Office rules impacting those affected by the scandal were irrational and in some cases had even led to the unlawful denial of British citizenship.
What it shows you is that this government has put tripwires at every stage of this application process in order to weed out and disqualify people who suffered enormously, but they needed an administrative excuse in order to deny them compensation. And that the High Court has ruled against the government is a huge disgrace for this government. But they won't be feeling any shame, because this government and Boris Johnson and Priti Patel in particular seem to take great glee and delight in revelling in racism.
Other Windrush victims are still fighting to get any justice or government support, with one even saying that they had had more support from the local supermarket than the Home Office.
We've had ruthless deportations of Jamaicans who committed no crime other than parking fine and lived here for 20, 30 years, got their families here. All the evidence shows us that when it comes to British immigration policy, it is ruthlessly targeted on the non-white, the African and Muslim and Asian communities. And of that, I don't think there can be any doubt.
The Windrush scandal, which first made headlines several years ago, continues with more deportations likely planned in the near future, with the government remaining squarely in the spotlight with thousands of people demanding action. The Windrush scandal, almost exclusively impacting Britain's black communities, continues to have a devastating effect, with the government appearing to have taken no serious action to stop the injustice. Richard Sudan, London.
The lineup for Iran's June 18th presidential election is gradually shaping up as more contenders from both ends of the political spectrum are entering the race. On Friday and the fourth day of the registration, hopefuls from both the principalist and the reformist camp showed up at the registration venue.
The U.S. dominance on the world as Saudi petrodollars have prevented many countries from standing up to bullying. So we need to strengthen ourselves on the global stage through public diplomacy. We have not worked on this issue.
While on different platforms, Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has underlined that he will not run for president. There are still speculations suggesting that he may change course in the last minute, in which case he would be a top aspirant from the reformist camp.
Outgoing President Hassan Rouhani will hand over the power with some of his tasks unfinished. On top of them is the fate of the nuclear deal and an economy that's facing crippling U.S. sanctions.
The election comes against the backdrop of the Vienna talks between Iran and other parties to the 2015 nuclear deal over ways to revive the ailing accord, after the U.S. scrapped the deal in 2018 and reinstated sanctions before Iran reduced its nuclear obligations in retaliation. Now, the outlook for the deal is a key question that's posed to both reformists and principalists.
The nuclear deal is not limited to one specific administration. It was approved by Parliament, the National Security Council, and our leader. So any succeeding government needs to live up to the terms of the deal on the condition that our rights are fulfilled under the accord. If not, there is no reason to do more than our legal responsibility.
The principalists are expected to have a stronger presence in the race. Among the prominent principalist figures who have applied to stand are Judiciary Chief Ebrahim Raisi, former Parliament Speaker Ali Larijani, and Secretary of the Expediency Council Mohsen Rezai. The final list of the contenders will be drawn up on May 27th, after the election vetting body, known as the Constitutional Council, reviews the credentials of the runners. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
After a relatively quiet time on the Lampedusa island, with only a few migrant boat landings per day recorded last year, the number of asylum seekers arriving by sea in Italy has started to pick up again over the past months, to the point that Italian authorities are alarmed by developments in the area. Around 13,000 people seeking asylum have arrived in Lampedusa by sea since the start of 2021, up from about 4,000 in the same period last year.
The real issue here is not the number of migrants arriving in Italy, Malta, Spain and Greece, which is still relatively low compared to previous years, but rather the contribution one expects from all other EU member states in terms of solidarity. Lampedusa doesn't have the health facilities to provide assistance to thousands of migrants in this pandemic crisis.
Over 2,000 migrants landed on the Italian island of Lampedusa between Sunday and Monday. Following the arrivals, the European Union's Home Affairs Commissioner called on member states to show solidarity with Italy and support the relocation of migrants. However, a European Commission spokesperson has said that despite contacts with several member states, no specific pledge has been received so far. At an ongoing conference organized by the Portuguese duty presidency of the EU in Lisbon, Italian Interior Minister Luciana Lamorgese has called on Brussels to find a long-term structural solution on how to manage asylum seekers. The minister has urged the activation of concrete, solid solidarity mechanisms, as well as a shared strategy to counter the smuggling of human beings and illegal immigration.
This is the other question of Lamorgese said also, humanitarian evacuation from Libya. They have already started, but again, it is dependent on the willingness of states to say, okay, I take 5,000 people from Libya.
According to Italian intelligence sources, there is an estimated 900,000 migrants in Libya kept in appalling living conditions in detention centers where abuse and torture are rife. About 1,000 people trying to reach Europe by sea have been returned to the North African country since the start of May. Max Civili, Rome.
After the Eid al-Fitr prayers, Yemenis came together outside the UN office in Yemen's capital Sana'a to restate the demands of the international community to take real measures against the Saudi blockade on Yemen.
Yemenis celebrate Eid al-Fitr this year amid the continued aggression and blockade, and the sufferings of Yemenis are increasing due to the continued detention of fuel ships by the Saudi-led coalition, which has caused a severe fuel crisis. We regret to see the United Nations and the international community silent towards our suffering.
Protesters slammed Saudi Arabia for its continued detention of oil vessels that has left their country in a desperate struggle to survive amid the harsh shortage of fuel. They said Riyadh has to release their tankers to prove its good intentions for moving towards a political solution.
Piracy acts against Yemeni oil ships are continuing under the leadership of the United States
with the participation of the United Nations. We are about to reach the end of the May, and the Saudi coalition has only allowed one ship to enter the country since the beginning of 2021. The United Nations bears full responsibility for the humanitarian situation in Yemen.
Saudi Arabia and its allies imposed an all-out blockade on Yemen since the beginning of the war in March 2015, depriving millions of Yemenis of their basic needs. The United Nations described the situation in the war-torn country as the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Yemenis believe that the United Nations bears responsibility for their suffering as it provides the political cover-up for Riyadh and its allies. They say the international community must break its silence and pressure Saudi Arabia to lift the siege from their country. Abdulatif Roshali, Sana'a.
In London, thousands hit the streets, furious at Israel demanding an end to the continued onslaught of Palestinians, while incensed at the evident bias in much of the mainstream media coverage, which is accused of shamelessly pushing the Israeli narrative.
There's a well-established channel between the Israeli government and between all mainstream news sources, meaning that they get threatened with legal action, they get aggressive emails and letters and even tweets from members of the Israeli government.
All the media pretty much has been disgraceful, and they do, they buy this narrative that these are clashes between two hostile camps that are completely incomprehensible, as if, you know, both sides are equally culpable. What is happening here is a continuation, a deepening, an acceleration of Israeli aggression.
Organisations like the BBC, funded by the British taxpayer, claim to be impartial, but have come under fire for presenting the murder of Palestinians as an equal conflict of two sides, and in the past of yielding to Israeli pressure over the nature of their coverage, and of simply not doing their job of reporting the truth of the reality of the war against the Palestinians. While Israel shows no sign of stopping the attacks on Palestinian men, women and children, millions around the world are demanding an end to the slaughter, and that mainstream media, which maintains incredible influence over public opinion, tell the facts and the truth about the devastating, deadly impact of the brutalization of the Palestinians.
As Israeli occupation forces continue to kill innocent Palestinians, media outlets like the BBC stand accused of siding with Israel, presenting a false narrative which is a far cry from reality. Richard Soudan, London.
Scores of people have registered to take part in the 13th Iranian presidential election. On the third day, some reformist hopefuls turned up at the election office of the Interior Ministry. Former parliament members Ali Mutahari and Mahmoud Sadeghi presented their plans to the reporters.
Everyone, even the anti-establishment people, the supporters of the previous regime, and even the BBC reporters must be allowed to talk. Our red line is to create chaos, but making a speech is absolutely free.
I want to be the voice of the people based on the experience I gained from representing the people in the parliament, as well as relying on my profession, which is advocacy.
Mohsen Mehralizadeh was another hopeful who gave his credentials to the Interior Ministry to send his name to the Constitutional Council for final approval. He has served as governor and minister in different cabinets.
Social, cultural, and economic factors all affect the consciousness of society. If we can solve the economic problem in this country, the situation will improve. Economy is a priority of the country today, and if we pay attention to the economy and people are freed from this poverty, unemployment, and related problems, vitality will return to society as a result.
Ramin Mehmanparas, former Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman, also announced his bid to contend for the post. On the first 2 days, men with military backgrounds, including Mohammad Hassan Nami, ex-defense minister Hossein Dehghan, and the IRGC commander Saeed Mohammed, also signed up to run. The other ones who showed up were former petroleum minister Rostam Qasemi, ex-sports minister Mohammad Abbasi, current deputy parliament speaker Amir Hossein Ghazizadeh Hashemi, and also some other previous parliamentarians. 2 days left until the end of the deadline to register for presidential elections, and some high-profile figures have not shown up yet. We have to wait and see that who are the final contenders to run. Human Abedi, Tehran.
The legacy of the past in the north of Ireland still haunts the present, particularly as the victims of the violence are still searching for the truth. For the family of those killed in the Ballymurphy massacre in 1971, their fight, first and foremost, was to set the record straight, and after 50 long years, their wait was finally over. As a coroner inquest ruled that 10 civilians, including a mother of 8 and a Catholic priest, killed across 3 days, were entirely innocent. The inquest found that at least 9 of the 10 killed were shot by the British Army, and that the force used was disproportionate, considering the paratroopers were firing from protected positions from a long distance away.
The coroner's court heard almost 100 days of evidence from more than 150 witnesses to conclude what the families of the deceased have known for 50 years, that their loved ones were entirely innocent and should not have been shot dead that day. But why have they had to wait so long for this verdict?
While the families have been vindicated, the fight to bring the perpetrators to justice is still not over, according to Patrick O'Murray, a human rights lawyer who represents them.
Prosecutions have been very rare in this jurisdiction, arising from the conflict when those who perpetrated the events are state actors. Many families would argue that we have had a de facto amnesty for British soldiers and police officers, where they haven't been subject to the normal rules of the criminal justice system or the rigours of the law.
The families feel their loved ones were killed twice, first by the British soldiers, and then their characters assassinated by the British state. Inside and outside the court, the families cheered the fact that after a long and hard-fought battle, the truth had been acknowledged and the names of their loved ones exonerated. But their cheers were bittersweet because not everyone lived long enough to see this day. Ahmed Cabello, London.
In the wake of the Israeli regime's attacks on Jerusalem al-Quds, pro-Palestinian demonstrators took over Downing Street in the British capital, London. The demonstrators even managed to clear out a small group of pro-Zionist demonstrators and chanted in solidarity with the Palestinian uprising against the occupation, sending a strong message of international solidarity.
Outrage is what's being voiced here on the streets of London today after Israel's assault on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Jerusalem al-Quds, as well as the attacks and the eviction of Palestinians from their homes in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. On top of that as well, of course, people are voicing their frustration and condemnation of the British silence over the massacres committed in the Gaza Strip.
Now they're attacking the Gaza Strip as well. They're attacking the Al-Aqsa Mosque at a time when, in the middle of Ramadan, at the most holy time for the Muslim people. This is an acceleration of the general attacks on the Palestinians, and it's completely unacceptable.
Since 1917, the British government has supported the Zionist project in Palestine, the settler colonial project that expelled the Arab Palestinians from their land, and which, to this day, continues to deny them their basic human rights. And today, now we see Israel is continuing this and ramping it up and is now trying to expel people from Jerusalem, from East Jerusalem, which is occupied by Israel illegally.
Demonstrators also expressed their outrage over Britain's allowing for the production of weapons to be used by the Israeli military and the UK's historic support for Israel.
According to the arms trade treaty that Britain is a signatory on, they are legally obliged to assess whether the hardware that they're selling to another country is likely to be used for human rights violations. When, following the 2014 war in Gaza, where you saw the massacre in Shaja'iyah, Britain, within weeks of it, Vince Cable, the business secretary, rubber-stamped the sales of millions of pounds of weaponry to Israel.
With the Gaza Strip under bombardment as the armed resistance fires rockets at Israel, the Palestinian people rise up throughout the occupied territories. This is whilst the international solidarity seems to now be stronger than ever. Robert and Lakesh, London.
In
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
People who limit the Quran to worshipping and personal matters haven't understood it. This is a part of a speech delivered on April 14, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution at the annual Ramadan Quranic meeting. The speech was delivered via video conference with the participation of a number of prominent Quranic reciters.
The difference between khashya and khawf. Of course, khashya is different from khawf. Khashya is the feeling that one gets as a result of realizing the magnificence of one person. This is called khashya. Khashya in the face of the God of the world results from understanding the greatness of God, the Omnipotent. those truly fear Allah among His servants who have knowledge. Chapter 35, verse 28. Those who have a greater understanding and more knowledge are equipped with khashya. Of course, the words khawf and khashya should not be misinterpreted as meaning that the holy nature of God is frightening. This is not the case. You can but admonish such a one as follows the message and fears the most gracious unseen. There is fear of God, but His mercy is there as well. There is fear towards a merciful being who is the manifestation of kindness to humanity, and this fear is because of His greatness. In sum, the month of Ramadan is the month of the Quran, and one can really benefit from Quranic guidance. We should read the Quran a lot and read it carefully and with deliberation. We should read it with attention to Allah the Exalted. Also, we should ask Allah the Exalted Himself when reciting the Holy Quran, and we should know that our hearts will shine with the Quran. The Commander of the Faithful says, Allah the Glorified has not counseled anyone with anything like this Quran. This is from the very beautiful Sermon 176 of Nahjul Balagha, where the Commander of the Faithful speaks about the Quran. I have sometimes read parts of this sermon in my speeches. Here he says, Allah the Glorified has not counseled anyone with anything like this Quran. Not in any other divine book has Allah the Exalted guided people in the same way that He has guided and taught humanity with the Quran. For it is the strong rope of Allah and its trustworthy means. It contains the blossoming of the heart and springs of knowledge. It makes hearts spring-like. It makes them fresh and green. It turns the heart into the ground for cultivating divine and true teachings. It contains the blossoming of the heart and springs of knowledge. For the heart, there is no other gloss than the Quran. The word gloss was used by the Commander of the Faithful. Greetings be upon him.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Aperture. Welcome back, everyone. In the first part, we saw how in 1951, inhabitants of a French village were suddenly tormented by terrifying hallucinations. At least seven people died, dozens were taken to a local asylum, and hundreds were affected. Immediately, wild theories started emerging to explain this mysterious case of mass insanity. There were claims of poisoned flour, contaminated water, and even witchcraft. The truth was stranger than any of these theories. The Central Intelligence Agency had spiked the local food with LSD as part of a mind control experiment at the height of the Cold War. And with time, U.S. government's interest in LSD shifted from a defensive to an offensive orientation. While the initial experiments with LSD were fairly simple, if shockingly unethical, over time, these LSD experiments grew increasingly elaborate. Stay with us as victims reveal the naked truth in the next part of this program.
Entire populations bore the consequence of large-scale tests. Here are some examples. Again, uncontested cases that are recognized by the American government. In 1953, radioactive iodine was injected into newborns and pregnant women at Iowa University and also in Nebraska. In 1955, the CIA sprayed whooping cough bacteria off the coast of Tampa. Two died, and dozens fell ill. Also in 1955, the CIA enlisted prostitutes in San Francisco, opened two brothels and tested drugs on the clients, then filmed through a one-way mirror. In 1956, the Army released millions of mosquitoes carrying yellow fever and dengue on the towns of Savannah and Avon. There were several deaths and hundreds of people infected. In 1960, in Cincinnati, the Army financed a radiation program on 90 destitute or ill inhabitants of the city's university hospital. Some died after several weeks. In 1966, the Army tested a virus in the New York Metro, then in Chicago. The bacteria was concealed in electric bulbs. The aim was to study the spread of chemical agents on a large scale. For these experiments, the Army or the CIA funded laboratories in the most prestigious universities: Yale, Stanford, Harvard, or Columbia. They all took part. Glorified by the idea of working for the nation's defense, the researchers went crazy.
Dr. Kligman in Philadelphia increases a dosage 468 times, which actually frightened Dow Chemical. They couldn't believe that a respected doctor would do that. In Washington, D.C., you had Walter Freeman, who was a very, very well-known lobotomist who traveled around the country doing lobotomies in his car. And he would use an ice pick. He could do 15 to 20 in a day. It was just incredible what some doctors did. And very few, if any, people in the hospital or the medical community blew the whistle on it. It really was an egregious act, and it showed that the medical community was more interested in protecting its ass than in protecting the test subject and the patients, because a lot of doctors went off the deep end and started doing things that are just inconceivable now.
To express his indignation, Alan Hornblum wrote half a dozen books. A former prison guard at Holmesburg in Pennsylvania, from his first day at work over 40 years ago, he had a horrible shock.
I was stunned to see scores of inmates with their shirts off, strapped and wrapped in bandages and gauze tape. And I couldn't imagine that I was going into an atmosphere that was that violent, because all of the men looked like they had just walked a cell block knife fight.
They explain that it's not because of any violence, but experiments that are carried out there. Alan was the first to denounce this scandal and would lose his job as a result.
It was probably the largest human experimentation factory in America, possibly the world. From 51 until 1974, more people were probably incorporated in more experiments than any other place in the world.
cancerous cells, plutonium, sarin gas. The most toxic products were tested in Holmesburg, but also in dozens of prisons throughout the country. To condemn these experiments, Alan Hornblum found former inmates like Youssef. In 1961, this man was imprisoned for selling marijuana. He was poor, with limited education. He was offered a chance to take part in tests for $1 a day. Since then, Youssef has had his digestive tract operated on. He has liver and skin problems and can no longer work. His first test was for a bath foam from the company Johnson & Johnson.
They took tape and they stuck it on your back and pulled it off, stuck it on and pulled it off until the first layer of skin came off your back. And they put six sections on my back like that. And then they took a bottle with the Johnson & Johnson bubble bath and put it on a patch and put the patch over the raw area. Then they took a can. I recognized that can as being from the Army. And I was like, what Johnson & Johnson got to do with this? So he took the can and he sprayed it on my back. And when it hit my back, it was cold. But it was so toxic, and like fumes, I could taste it in my mouth. And as I'm walking down, I'm getting dizzier and dizzier. By the time I stepped into my cell, I passed out. Boom, and my back was inflamed. And by the time I woke up that morning, I had great big blisters on my back full of pus. This rash just gets worse and worse. And it looks like when the moon come out at night, it flames up, and I'll be moaning and crying and moaning and crying. My cell partners couldn't sleep. We goes over there, a little shot cup, and it looked like water. We drinks it. Everything became magnified. The sound, like the loudspeaker on the system. Ooh, ooh, ooh. The walls look like they turn into water. You know what I mean? And like I spent the whole time like looking around like this here instead of doing the test. So I go back to the block in that condition. And man, I mean, I was tripping. And it was like a slow acting drug that was in that cup. It lasts for weeks. The inmates start naming me Outer Limits. I had no conversation for nobody. I was scared of the inmates, and the inmates act like they was afraid of me.
What you had were hundreds and hundreds of uneducated minorities, overwhelmingly black and Puerto Rican. And then you had white doctors with white lab coats with PhD or MD after their name. And it was a recipe for abuse, if not disaster. And those prison walls are an ideal spot to do controversial experiments because just as those walls keep the inmates in, they also keep the public out. So no one finds out about it.
Prisoners were used, but also patients. In certain hospitals, patients were steered towards the services financed by the CIA. These services carried out limitless experiments on psychological manipulation. In 1965, Karen Wetmore was only 13 when she was admitted to a hospital in Vermont. She stayed there several times in her childhood. She suffered from severe depression after falling victim to a pedophile neighbor. Admitted against her will, she was not allowed any contact with her family, being told that it was for her own good.
The CIA was specifically looking for children between the ages of 13 and 18 to further dissociate. They wanted dissociative children. There's a sense of absolute and total helplessness. You're there, you're bound up, you're locked in this room, no matter how you scream. No matter what you say, no one is going to come. It does something to you, something you don't get over.
The doctors went to work on Karen. They wanted to erase her memory and create a robot at their command. It took 30 years of legal battles for Karen to obtain her medical records and discover the violence of the treatments she was subjected to.
It says seclusion, full can.